Okay, I'd like to call the August meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Health Commission to order. First on the agenda is approval of the minutes that were sent out to the commissioners. Are there any changes?
I move approval.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Minutes are approved. Now we're open to public comment, and this is where a person's desiring to speak on issues other than scheduled items that are within the scope of the Health Commission. Are there any public comments?
Good evening. My name is Kenna Burke. I am the new Government Relations, Community Relations Officer for the Community Health Centers of the Central Coast. I wanted to come and introduce myself to you and let you know that if you have any questions or would like information or anything, you are welcome to call me. I have cards that some of you received. I'll pass them out. And just to let you know, hello, and you've got a face to contact if you've got any questions.
Thank you. Any further public comments? Then let's move into the next agenda item, which is an overview of health agency organization and programs. And I believe Mr. Hamm is the first. Thank you.
Good evening. How's everybody tonight?
Good.
Good. This is going to be pretty informal, if that's okay with you. I had asked Jean, and I think she had included or had distributed to you a staff report that we submitted to the board about 18 months ago. It happened to be National Association of Counties Month, and they picked health care services as their theme in 2010, and so it was a perfect opportunity for us. The board had a special meeting on March 30th, and we presented a very similar overview as the one that it seemed to me that you guys had, the commission was looking for. And so rather than rewrite a staff report that I thought was still fairly germane and applicable, I just distributed that one to you. I don't know if you've had an opportunity to look at it or if you have any specific questions, but I can certainly respond to any that you might have. I think Jean also handed out an org chart, or maybe a couple different pages, and would ask you to direct your attention to the health agency sort of summary overview. The health agency is comprised, as you probably know, of public health department and a behavioral health department. And while the behavioral health department has existed on paper for years, and I think sometimes until the budget reflects something, it doesn't really exist that way. And so we finally going into 11-12 fiscal year, officially consolidated what had historically been separate organizations for drug and alcohol services and mental health. So now if you look in the county budget for this year, you won't see drug and alcohol or mental health departments. You'll see a behavioral health fund center. So along with the public health department and its programs and the behavioral health department, there is an administrative unit. That's a separate unit as opposed to in the earlier iterations of the health agency, the administrative staff, including the IT support staff and the HR staff, were sort of dispersed, and behavioral health programs had their own, and public health programs had their own. When the health agency was reconvened in about 2004, it was designed in this way so that the administrative support functions were separate and existed to support both, not only both the public health department and the behavioral health department, but the other two programs that are shown on the org chart, which are not department-level organizations, but animal services, which the Board of Supervisors added to the health agency January 2009. They'd gotten kicked around is the wrong term, but they had gotten moved around several times from a freestanding department to a division of the health agency to a division of the sheriff's office, and then back in 2009 into the health agency again. And you'll also notice Public Guardian, which is a much smaller division, amounting to six or seven employees, counting yourself?
Six.
In terms of the history of the Public Guardian, used to be Frank Freitas, the Treasurer, Tax Collector, Public Administrator, used to introduce himself as Treasurer, Tax Collector, Public Administrator, Public Guardian. But in the mid or late 80s, grand jury did an investigation into the nature of how the Public Guardian's office was working and concluded that it would be more appropriate for it to be more closely aligned with, at the time, the Mental Health Department. And so it was, the Board of Supervisors moved it into the health agency. And I think it was the late 80s. That's an overview of the agency. And I could respond to any questions that you have now about the materials that we've distributed for your information. What we're planning to do is have Dr. Anderson, who is the Animal Services Manager, make a brief presentation to you about animal services and those programs under which that he manages. And then Lisa Neeson, who's the Chief Deputy Public Guardian, is also here. She's going to talk a little bit about the Office of the Public Guardian, the functions that office performs. And they, of course, will be happy to respond to any questions that you have. And then when they're done, I'm going to give you a very brief, high-level behavioral health overview and see if, based on that information, you're interested in having folks come to another meeting, perhaps, to delve into any of the aspects of the Behavioral Health Department. So does that seem like an okay approach? So do you have any questions for me now, or should we go to...
This one. Okay. When the Animal Services Division was moved over from the Sheriff's Department, was the... did the money come with it?
Yes.
So the Sheriff's Department was reduced by that a certain amount, and the Health Department was increased by the same amount?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and the Animal Services Division is a freestanding fund center.
Uh-huh.
So you can look it up in the budget. You can see it, and you wouldn't know without reading, you know, the narrative description that it isn't a standalone department, which you could have said that before when it was a division of the Sheriff's Office, because in terms of its finances...
Yeah.
It's a distinct unit.
Yes.
Do you serve at the pleasure of the Board of Supervisors?
I do.
Any further questions? All right, thanks.
Okay. So I don't know what order. I don't know if they Rochambeau'd to see who was going to go first or not. Or.
Good evening. I'm Eric Anderson. I'm the Animal Services Manager. So I went ahead and put together a real brief overview or document that I think you have there in front of you, overview of animal services. As Mr. Hamm said, we've been kicked around the county for different departments and different locations for a while. I like to think that everybody's had the opportunity to share in the experience of animal services. So we actually, historically, animal services, not in the county, but as a general concept, animal control organizations around the state, around the country, came to be and evolved out of public health concern, really focused on rabies at one point. And so initially a lot of them wound up being under the health departments where they were originally formed. And as rabies has come to be a less pressing concern for the communities, and we've grown to have a increasing awareness and concern for animal welfare and then the public safety issues related to animals as well, there's been a shift in a lot of communities about what to do with animal services. So it's sort of been reflected in how we've moved around the county over the years. As was mentioned, at one point we were a standalone department, and that was the Department of Animal Regulation. We also then were put under the Health Department as the Animal Regulation Division, and then in 1998, sort of paralleling that change to perspective on the public safety function and animal welfare and so forth, moved out of the Public Health Department and were set as a division of the Sheriff's Department. At the time that happened, the name also changed a little bit to, I think, reflect also differing changes in the perspective of what the division was about. So it stopped being Animal Regulation and started becoming Animal Services. We were the Animal Services Division of the Sheriff's Department from 1998. Moving forward, I've been there since 2001. And then in 2009, we moved back out of the Sheriff's Department, and there was some discussion as to what would happen to Animal Services, and the ultimate conclusion was to go back under the Health Agency. So we've been there for the last couple of years. I think actually it's done very well and served us very well. I think we've benefited from some of the management structure, fiscal support that's available in the Health Agency and so forth. I've included an organization chart for us here, and you might note it's a little bit different than what you see that's presented to you there. This is sort of the pragmatic view of how things work. And so Animal Services really has two primary functions that we do. There's the shelter services, which is the physical plant, and the animal housing operation that we do and what a large part of the community is familiar with. There's also our field services function. Those are the officers out in the field addressing a lot of community issues. And then we have a smaller role, not that it's less important, it just simply is not received the same level of funding and staffing of humane education for the public. We also have a number of administrative and clerical staff which work within our operation that are specific and dedicated to us, and that work to support those two other operations, doing things, everything from licensing services, customer service, dispatch functions for our officers in the field and so forth. They actually are part of the agency's administrative section or administrative operation and report up through that chain, but because of the operation, they're closely entwined and sort of work as just another level of our staffing there as well. I work relatively closely with the administrative group to try and provide direction and function for them. So as far as our operation, our budget is about $2.3 million annually. A large portion of our funding, close to half of that, actually comes from contract fees. We provide animal care and control functions throughout the county, all the unincorporated communities, as well as each of the seven cities. The cities then pay a contract fee, which is determined based on a proportionality of how much of our services they use. So rather than just by population or geographic size or any of those random assessments, it's actually based on the amount of services that they receive or what we provide for them. In addition to the contract fees, we receive support through the general fund budget, and then also the sale of licenses, permits, and some regulatory fees that are assessed through the organization. And those are about equal at about a quarter of our budget. And then the remaining portion, about 17% there, is for service charges. And those relate from anything for impound fees, pickup fees for services provided to the public, boarding fees for animals that are impounded in state and county and so forth. As far as our expenses and our outflow, about $1.5 million of that is for salaries and benefits, and then a little over, just under $900,000 goes to our services and supplies. The majority of our service supply operations actually have to do with animal housing, facilities management, and so forth. So as far as what Animal Services does, as I mentioned, we provide animal care and control services throughout the entire county, including the incorporated communities. That's about 3,300 square miles. And I'm sorry, that's a typo. It's 265,000 citizens. Within the incorporated communities, we do all companion animal concerns. So that would be dogs, cats, snakes, rabbits, and also includes livestock. So some of the communities, Paso Robles, Atascadero, have small populations of horses, sheep, cattle, and so forth. And so in those areas, we provide the animal care and control services there. Within the unincorporated communities, the livestock functions actually are assigned to the Sheriff's Department still. They have deputies that are their ag crime deputies that are specifically assigned to that function. The field services section has a number of different roles that they play. The primary or the number one mission of that operation is public safety, dealing with aggressive animals that may be threatening the public, dogs that are out in the community running at large, either aggressive towards other animals or towards people. Additionally, they respond to complaints or reports of animal abuse and neglect. They serve to assist and rescue injured or ill animals. Animals may be in danger that trapped in a water drain or something along that line. And a large portion of what they deal with also are more routine animal nuisance issues, barking complaints, dogs running at large, knocking over trash cans, those sorts of things. And then we also provide interagency assistance for mostly other law enforcement agencies. If they're conducting an arrest or a warrant service and there happen to be animals on the property, our officers will go out and assist them in that process. And then we still maintain sort of the historic function, and it's still a while it's maybe not as much of the workload, the importance is still critically important, and probably I think overlaps a little bit more with some of the interests or the perspective of your organization, and that's our rabies control and quarantine that that we do. So we do the surveillance and quarantine and assistance, or in conjunction with the health department, the public health lab. And that function is both for domestic and wild animals. So we collect and then submit rabies tests to the health lab for any animals that have bitten a person or are subject to evaluation. Alternatively, for domestic animals, we do quarantine and observe for rabies in the case of an animal bite if the euthanasia of the animal isn't necessarily appropriate or elected at that point. Just for reference, in 2010, we had 684 animal bites reported in the county. Most of those are domestic animals involved there. Additionally, the field services conducts licensing. This, again, is derived mostly from a rabies control perspective. All dogs over the age of 4 months in the county are required to be licensed through our office. Last year, in 2010, we sold 14,811 licenses, and there were a total of 23,822 dogs that were licensed. So a number of the dogs that are licensed have a multiple-year license. That's why those numbers are a little bit different. That comes out to probably about a third of the animals or the dogs in the county that are licensed. So the compliance, well, it sounds a little bit low, actually, compared to some of the other communities, is not too bad. And then the last function they do is commercial animal operations inspection, regulation, and permitting. So boarding facilities, pet shops, stables, horse strings, any commercial animal operation within the county is required to be inspected, permitted by our office. The only exception are veterinary hospitals and grooming facilities that don't keep animals overnight. The shelter operations side of the organization serves largely to take in stray homeless animals or owner-surrendered animals. Last year, we took in just over 5,200 dogs and cats with a redemption rate of about 788 animals. That's runs around 20%. The majority of those, by far, are dogs. Our redemption rate for dogs is about 45%. For cats, it's about 1 or 2%. So the reclaim rate on cats is quite low, and that remains one of our primary challenges is the cat population in the county. We also do adoption and rescue placements for those animals. So about 3,100 animals were placed by adoption last year. And between our redemption rate and our adoption placements, our called our live animal outcome, the animals going out the shelter, comes out to about 75% for last fiscal year. It's a little bit lower than where we have been historically, which is about 80 to 85%. That also includes animals that are brought to us with a request for euthanasia by their animal owners at the end of their life, where their quality of life is beginning to suffer. And that rate's significantly high compared to a number of the other counties around the community. So we've seen some significant decrease in our euthanasia rates over the last several years, and that's sort of reflected in the graph down below there. You'll note the increase has been occurring the last couple of years, and it's primarily in cats that we're seeing that. Again, feral cats and unowned cats is where the large issue is there that's sort of conflicting for our county. From about 2003 to 2006, we actually had a zero euthanasia for adoptable animals, so all the animals represented there are either feral, aggressive, ill, or injured, and so forth. And then the other functions that we perform are emergency animal holding or custodial impound. So individuals that are arrested with an animal in their possession, the animal comes to us, those guys go to jail. People that may be incapacitated either through injury or other disability that they're hospitalized, don't have immediate next of kin to take care of their animals, we'll take custody of them for a period of time. And then we do provide veterinary care in the shelter for animals that are in our care. It's usually a basic level veterinary function at the hospital or at the clinic there. I'm sorry, at the shelter. We do refer out to area clinics animals that require more extensive care. We're not particularly equipped facility-wise or staffing to provide significant long-term or ongoing care for those animals. And then we do euthanasia and aftercare for both the animals at our shelter that we're dealing with, as well as publicly owned animals. A couple of things there I noted on the bottom there that we don't do, sometimes a little confusion about wildlife management. It's not actually a role of animal services. It's not within our mission or our charge. We do take on wildlife cases in situations where fish and game officials are close by. The wardens are stretched far enough that oftentimes our officers are called on to deal with it just simply by lack of anybody else. And then owned animal assistance, so veterinary care for owned animals or transport of animals and things like that. And then, as I mentioned, within the unincorporated areas, livestock actually falls to the sheriff's ag crime deputies. So that's it really quick and in a real quick nutshell, but I'd be glad to answer any questions that you have on that.
Any questions for the commissioners? Yes.
Thank you very much for your report. On the animal nuisance piece, I noticed a lot in the city's newspaper, like the Red Light Roundup in Atascadero.
Right.
They do a lot of animal nuisance calls.
Right.
Those go to, how does that work between you and the city?
So we're contracted with each of the cities to provide all their animal care control stuff, and that would be all those animal nuisance things. I think a lot of those actually are pulled off of the police logs, and so a lot of times a citizen in the city will call the police department and say, hey, there's a dog barking right down the street or whatever it happens to be. Our office and our officers are in the field during daytime hours, so they're out until about 6 o'clock at night, and then after that, we have officers that are on call. They'll respond to emergency situations where there's an immediate risk to the public safety or other animals with a dangerous animal running at large, or where there's an immediate animal welfare issue, say a dog that's been hit by a car or something along that line. They don't respond to nuisance issues of dogs barking at 2 o'clock in the morning. There's just simply too much of that for them to be able to do. So some of those calls go to the police department. They'll either log that and then refer it to us the next day, and we'll send an officer out to deal with it in daytime hours. If they don't have much going on, sometimes the police department will deal with it. Honestly, a lot of times they just actually would rather refer it over to us. So they'll make a note of it on their record and refer those over to us to handle during our hours.
Okay. And I have another question, too, maybe more for the general public. If someone suspects a rabid animal, there to call you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, they could. That would be the best place to call our frontline, 781-4400. Normally, you know, we deal with two issues there. There's the domestic animal side of it, and then there's the wildlife side. The concern is just as real for both. The frequency or incidence of domestic animals in the county is and around the state exceptionally low. We still take it very seriously because of the potential consequences of an actual exposure. We do have a prevalence and endemic presence in our wildlife population, particularly with bats, skunks, and raccoons. Those are the animals that we generally caution people about contacting with particular care, particularly in those animals that are out behaving abnormally, out at a time that they shouldn't be. Any wild animal that seems tame and handleable, you know, it may be enticing to want to pick up or handle one of those animals, but we're pretty adamant about instructing people to avoid any contact, calling our office. We'll dispatch an officer out to pick them up. That would be something that if there was a after-hours situation, we'd send an officer out on call for an emergency on.
Okay. Well, my concern around that is I live up in Cambria, and there are always people feeding
right. The
raccoons, and so there are some of them are going to be out in the daytime.
Yeah.
Same way with the squirrels that people are feeding out on the bluffs.
Yeah.
And so what is our rate? I know some years back we kind of had a rash of rabid animals. What's it been the last few years?
Well, and I think actually if you go back historically and look, it's there's not really a solid systematic sampling process. So if you go back and look, our positive reports a number of years ago were a fair bit higher than they are now. But the sampling process at the time was we were picking up roadkill and dead animals on the side of the road and testing those where there was no exposure, no contact. Anytime there was an opportunity to test an animal, it was tested. And we had a number more positives coming up at that time. Because of staffing issues and time and budget issues, we've stopped actually picking up animals where there's no contact. We know that it's a virus that's there in the wildlife population, and wouldn't be a surprise to know that we have some skunks or some raccoons that do have it. So we don't initially pick up every skunk on the side of the road and test it. So our incidence is lower than what it had been. I don't know that that necessarily means the prevalence is any lower, if that makes sense. Feeding wildlife is opening the door to all sorts of other problems, and certainly rabies infection is a major issue, particularly with raccoons and other animals that it attracts in. There's just simply a lot of nuisance issues that come along with that as well, as far as, you know, knocking over trash cans, interactions with our domestic animals and our pet animals, and then particularly in Cambria and some areas around Atascadero and so forth, we have people that are feeding deer and things as well. We have an issue with that, and that it also attracts predators along with those animals. So where we see increase in deer feeding, we have an increase in mountain lion sightings and things like that as well. So there's a public safety issue. It's a real issue, I mean, both for the rabies as well as a lot of other public safety concerns. So the general recommendation would be not to feed wildlife.
Thank you.
Yes.
Was your budget cut this year?
Yeah, we the health agency had a and maybe Mr. Ham can speak to that a little bit more, but had a target of, I believe, 10% overall reduction. Animal Services, as was mentioned earlier, we have a separate budget unit, and while we've been in different departments over time, we've sort of maintained our same budget, and to a certain degree with that respect are a little semi-independent in our function and structure. We were subjected to a 5% reduction on our budget, so we did reduce our budget this year. And the primary functions that we, or the primary areas that we reduced in were two services. Each year we release about $40,000, $30,000 of spay-neuter vouchers to assist and promote spay-neuter services around the county. We eliminated that as part of the budget. And then our second was we have a half-time position of a humane educator. And that person's job is to go out into the community and elementary schools and discuss responsible pet ownership practices and so forth. And that position was slated as a layoff. As a result of an agreement and offer from the employees' union that individual is part of. However, that position was funded through the rest of this year, and so they continue to be on staff right now and will be here through June. Barring any surprising changes, I would anticipate that position then is laid off next year.
Thank you for the good information.
Yes, sure, Warren.
I have one other question. That was in regarding the emergency animal holding and custodial impounds. Mm-hmm. Is that custodial impounds? Is that something new that when people are picked up and oftentimes their kids are taken? So could you explain that?
No, we've that's been something that we've done pretty much as long for longer than I've been there. I don't think it's anything particularly new. The term, we've. I actually changed the term at some point because it, I think, better reflects what the function is. It used to be PD or police department holds. A lot of those are people that are arrested for a DUI and have an animal with them, and we hold on to the animal while the person is in custody or maybe some other things. But we also deal relatively frequently where somebody passes away. There's no next of kin immediately in the area, and they have animals. So we'll take the animals for a few days until the next of kin can be contacted and the animal's released. Individuals that may actually have a involuntary mental health hold placed on them. We'll take animals in those situations, people that wind up in the hospital or things along that line without somebody for the animals to go to. So it's really more to help provide a temporary home for the animal while the owner is incapacitated or unable to provide for them. It's not custodial in that it's not a legal authority that we're exercising over taking the animal. We do animal seizures for their welfare as well. We generally consider those a separate group of animals, though, and in a situation where an animal is being abused or neglected, our officers do have the authority to summarily seize or remove them from the property or from the owner in the same way as somebody might a child that's being abused.
Okay, and then, so with those seized animals, mm-hmm. are they allowed to be picked up by next of kin to be taken care of while that person's incarcerated, or
you know, it kind of depends on the situation, and it's a relatively complex section of some of the stuff that we do. But really, in a nutshell, it's outlined in a section of the penal code. Anytime that we seize an animal under that authority, the animal owner is afforded the right to an administrative hearing into the validity of the seizure and whether or not the animal should be returned. The hearing is done internally. I usually do most of our hearings as long as they're conducted by a person superior in rank to the person doing the seizure. Once that hearing has been held, a determination is made as to whether or not the seizure is valid, as well as whether or not the person should get the animals back. If the decision is made that they don't get the animals back, then state law allows us to hold that animal either until such time as the hearing officer is assured that the conditions leading to the situation and the seizure have been resolved and won't come back to injure the animal, or more commonly, because once we get to that point, those people are usually prosecuted for animal cruelty, the animal usually stays in custody until such time as that case makes its way through court and there's either a conviction or a dismissal of the case found. Only in the case that the animal or the case was dismissed or found not guilty would they get the animals back. Additionally, once that hearing has been conducted and the decision made that the seizure is valid and we're holding the animals, the owner is subject or required to provide or pay boarding and fees associated with the seizure. Since some of those cases can take a long time, several months to actually the one that we have right now is about 18 months out, most people can't pay that boarding, so what winds up happening is the animals then are abandoned after 14 days. We take possession of them and then decide, do they need to be euthanized, do they need to be adopted out or placed with a rescue and so forth. It would be unusual for us to take an animal from an animal seizure for a cruelty issue and then place it back with the family where there's a reasonable likelihood that it may wind up back in that same situation, back with those same people.
Okay. If it's not an animal cruelty mm-hmm. piece, but the people are picked up for, say, drug possession.
Sure.
What happens to those animals?
In a situation where it's a custodial impound, whether it's you know, they're there because they've been arrested or otherwise they're in the hospital or whatever, we usually send a notification to the individual requesting them to either designate somebody to come and pick up the animal for them or to release the animal to our ownership so that we can adopt it out. And then we'll hold it. They have 14 days. And after, if there's no decision or action taken in 14 days, the animal's abandoned. We take possession of it. Normally what we try and do is get the animal back to the person or next of kin in those situations, though.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. I have a question. What is a publicly owned animal? Can you give me an example?
Your dog. Their dog's my dog.
Publicly owned?
Owned by a member of the public, I'm sorry. So, you know, it's owned by the private individual. The animals in the shelter are, I guess, technically public property since they belong to animal services, as it were.
And what do you take care of law enforcement? Animals, canines, or are there horses? Or I was thinking along those lines.
Yeah, I'm not. I don't believe there's any. Well, actually, I should take that back. Sheriff's posse does have some horses. Those are generally volunteers, and those are privately owned animals. There's not any law enforcement horses in the county that I'm aware of. There's a number of organizations that have canine units, and we don't deal with them directly. I mean, they're owned by the individual police departments trained, and they have their own individually assigned handlers. We deal with them only in those situations where there's a bite or they're subject to some of the same legal requirements, but we generally work together with enforcement on that.
So when a citizen licenses their dog,
mm-hmm.
it's a publicly owned animal?
I'm sorry, maybe that's confusing. Animals that are owned by members of the public, I guess, if that's more clear. Yeah.
Okay, just curious. And what's your board and care at night? What do you charge people?
It's $20 a day.
Any further questions? I have one question. Do you did your department look after, examine crows for, I believe, West Nile?
Yeah, that's one of the other smaller public functions or public health functions that we do. Actually, most of that is actually done through the state, the analysis or the evaluation of the West Nile virus. But in conjunction with the health lab here, we do receive the reports of the animals, dispatch officers out to pick up those samples, bring them back in, and they go over to the public health lab, and then the actual laboratory diagnostics and so forth are conducted through that side of it.
Do you know where we stand now with West Nile and how many we find yearly?
You know, I'd leave that to Dr. Bornstein to answer a little bit more specifically than I do. I haven't got the numbers on the avians that we've gotten, yeah.
I'll just chime in. We haven't had any reports of birds this year or last year, and it probably goes back a few years. I can get you the more specific information, but in our recent past, we haven't had any reports in wildlife or birds of West Nile virus findings.
Okay, thank you.
Or humans.
Good.
And I just piggyback onto that, and she might be able to correct me a little bit on this. My general impression is, again, I think that our sampling rate for those we're not picking up as many birds as we were when that was sort of the real hot topic out there. We had a real crush for picking up samples, and it doesn't seem that we're picking up nearly as many at this time.
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Anderson makes a good point, and I should note that there was a recent death in Santa Barbara County in a human from West Nile virus, so it is still around and still causing harm.
Okay. Thank you. No further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good evening. First of all, I would like to say what a pleasure it is to come before your commission and speak to you about the Office of the Public Guardian. My name is Lisa Neese, and I'm the Chief Deputy Public Guardian for the County of San Luis Obispo. I am a direct report to Mr. Hamm, who is the designated public guardian for the county, as designated by the Board of Supervisors. I've been with the county for 25 years, and with the Department of the Office of Public Guardian for the entire time I've been an employee with the county. I've been the Chief Deputy for the past 12 years. The Office of the Public Guardian acts as the court-appointed conservator for those individuals in our community who are unable to provide for themselves in a proper way for their food, clothing, or shelter. They're come to our attention through a number of ways, either through a facility who has come by means of a hospital or a psychiatric facility because that person is unable to care for themselves. There are two types of conservatorships in the state of California. There are a probate conservatorship and an LPS conservatorship. A probate conservatorship deals with an individual who is unable to care for themselves either physically or mentally due to deficits that they are experiencing. And usually those behaviors either come to the attention of a loved one, either by a doctor that they are seeing or a friend or perhaps even a neighbor. And we receive referrals from either one of those sources. And then we will receive a referral and we'll go out and do an investigation to determine if that person is in need of a conservatorship. Based on those factors, we then petition the court and make a determination whether or not they are in need of a conservatorship. Once a conservatorship is established, then the basic needs for their basic needs of food, clothing, and shelter are managed by our office. And at that point, several factors come into play. A conservatorship has three basic effects that take effect. It shifts the responsibility from the conservatee to the conservator to make those decisions. It also places limitations on the individual to make decisions that could be affecting their personal care or their financial decisions that are putting them at risk or at harm. And it also is, protects the person from others who perhaps are causing harm either physically or financially to that individual. And that's why they've come under the attention of the public guardian's office. A probate conservatorship can be of the person only, the estate only, or the person and estate combined. A probate conservatorship can last someone's lifetime or until that person is able to care for themselves again. Usually when the appointment of a public guardian becomes involved, it is my experience that the person becomes our responsibility for their lifetime. Mostly the public guardian's appointments are because there is no one else to become involved in this person's life, or the people that are involved in their life are found to be inappropriate. They've perhaps are family members that are unwilling to help their loved one, or perhaps they are the person that we've become involved to investigate because they are causing harm or undue influence on that loved one by either taking their finances away or causing harm to that individual with undue influence. We work very closely with the local police department in many ways in our investigations, also with the district attorney's office to complete our investigations and our cases for both the probate cases and some of our LPS cases that we become involved with. On the LPS conservatorship side of the conservatorships that we handle, that has to do with people who are suffering from a mental disease or disorder. And they have been determined to suffer from those mental diseases that cause them to fit the criteria of being deemed gravely disabled in the fact that they cannot provide for their food, clothing, or shelter. And those referrals can only come to our office from a licensed psychiatric facility. And that gives our office the authority to place someone involuntarily in a psychiatric facility to receive the treatment that they need to be able to become stable and productive citizens again in our community. And with the probate conservatorships, it's important to realize that if someone is appointed as a probate conservator, they do not have the authority to place someone involuntarily or in a locked facility. Some people get those distinctions confused, that if they are appointed as someone's conservator, they have the right to force treatment on someone, and that is not the case. As a probate conservator, if we do seek medical authorities or dementia powers, those are separate acts and separate powers that we seek from the court on special circumstances for each and individual case. So there's two distinct definitions for each conservatorship. Another thing that's important for people to understand is that when people are placed on a conservatorship, they think that someone has been deemed incompetent. That is also not the case. When someone's deemed incompetent, that's another separate act that is declared by a court action. Someone that's placed on a conservatorship, it just means that they're unable to manage their affairs. But it doesn't mean that they're incompetent, even if they are put on an LPS conservatorship. So that's important for people to understand. It just means that they are unable to make decisions for themselves, and the court has appointed a conservator, which is could be a public guardian or could be another third party that's interested in acting in that capacity, to make those decisions for them, whether it be of their person or their financial matters or for their medical decisions. But again, this county is very, very cautious about petitioning for medical authorities. That's a separate act. We do get medical authorities on certain cases, but that is after we seek special declarations from the treating physicians stating that that person needs those authorities placed on their special case for a conservator to act. In this county, we have approximately 80 cases that we handle on the LPS side of our conservatorship cases. We have 28 probate, and we also provide services to a payee program, which serves the individuals who perhaps are struggling in the community but don't need the restrictions placed on them as a conservatorship would do. They are case managed by case managers in a nonprofit or another governmental agency, and the public guardian only serves as the receiver and disperser of their governmental funds in which they are entitled to receive through Social Security. But we do not provide any case management services for them. So we're just a receiver and disperser of funds. But what that payee program does is it acts as a really nice buffer for those individuals who are struggling out in the community but don't need the restrictions of a conservatorship. So it's really been a nice program to provide services to those folks out there struggling but don't need the restrictions placed on them on a conservatorship. So it's been really nice to see those people be successful without being formally placed on a conservatorship. And we've had that program since the early 1990s. So that's a great program that we've been able to see put in place and be successful. Our staff has consisted, as Mr. Hamm was stating earlier to you, myself and five other individuals. Our individuals that we have in our office are all deputized. We are not sworn officers of the peace officer. We don't carry guns. We're just sworn officers of the court. We do a lot of things that people perhaps are not so happy to see us do, such as we have the authority to go in and freeze bank assets when we have a suspicion that assets are being mishandled or misappropriated by individuals with wrongdoing of perhaps potential referrals that we're going to be receiving. So besides police officers, we're the only individuals that can go in and freeze bank assets. So oftentimes we will accompany police officers on their cases that we think that we are going to be appointed on, and if we think that the case warrants our action, we can freeze those individual accounts if we think that we will petition the court to be appointed within 10 days. That's what the law requires us to be able to do. Because of the type of work that we do, our location is confidential. We don't make quick friends too easy on some of the cases that we handle. Family members or third parties aren't really anxious to see us knock on the door sometimes. So the type of people that we encounter aren't always easy to deal with or very friendly. So a lot of times we do act with police backup and support. And so some of the cases that we deal with can become very difficult. So our confidential, our location is confidential. All of the cases that we do deal with in court are supported by a deputy county counsel. We do a lot of legal paperwork and trial preparation and trial setting. Right now, all of our cases are heard by Judge Harmon in Department 8. We are in court on a regular basis on every Tuesday, but during our trial preparations and trial settings, there's regular times that we are in court several times a week. It is up to our office to set those trials and prepare for those trials where we have to get testimony prepared by family members, the conservatees, and also the treating psychiatrists. So we are very busy doing that type of activities as well. So our office is very unique in the health agency, but it's a very rewarding and very challenging career and an office as well. So is there any questions that you may have?
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're welcome.
For your presentation. What's the average age in these three different groups that you're talking about?
The average age for our LPS conservatees are anywhere from 18 to the mid-60s. The representative payee program is anywhere from 18 to, I think our oldest one is in their mid-50s. And then our probate is anywhere between, I think the youngest probate we have is in their early 50s on up to 95.
And another question I had, when you were talking about the LPS group, it says it needs to come, they need to have a psychiatrist recommend that they go to a facility?
I'll clarify that. Yeah. LPS conservatorships can only come referred to the public guardian's office by a locked psychiatric facility, meaning like our inpatient unit here in San Luis Obispo, or the other facility that we get recommendations from is Vista Del Mar, which is down in Ventura. And the reason why they come from Vista Del Mar is because anybody that is here as a resident in our county who has private insurance will come to our unit, but then is automatically shipped down to Vista Del Mar to receive services and treatment. But they're still a resident of our county, so they'll make a referral to our office for a recommendation for a conservatorship.
Okay. And then another question I had when you were talking about the payee program, and that there's case management by nonprofits. Now, if somebody's in your payee program, is it required, and do you check up to make sure that they have adequate case management?
It is a requirement of our payee program that they are case managed, and we have constant contact with the case managers because they're responsible to prepare a monthly budget, report any changes, and so if we are preparing checks for disbursements, we will know if something is not correct because the vendor will let us know that there's a mistake in either a payment of some sort or the client did not receive their check. The clients get checks on a weekly basis from our office. If the client is not receiving a case management services, then their case will be terminated from our office, because if they're not being case managed properly, we can't provide the financial services at an adequate level.
Okay, so that brings me to my final question, is we've had a number of high-profile cases with young people mentally ill that I know have wound up in the county's care at some point or another, that have committed horrendous crimes. And where did they fall through the cracks? Do you have any suggestions on that? Why weren't they in a facility somewhere? Or these were some serious mental issues. And what would you suggest, or what do you see as something that's not working?
I can't answer as to why those particular people fell through the cracks. I'm not sure what their circumstances were or why they didn't receive the services that perhaps they needed, or perhaps could have assisted their situation in a more timely manner. I only receive the cases that I receive through the Office of the Public Guardian on those cases that meet a really specific criteria. And that's when someone is deemed gravely disabled after they've met a 5150 and then a 14-day certification. And those certifications are approved by the Superior Court. So I can only report to you what I see from a process of certifications and approval from the court on those cases and those individuals that come through a process. I can't answer a question to as to those individuals that didn't meet a criteria and go through a court process.
And so does your department work very closely with mental health also, or is it just that they're kind of siloed and you only pick them up after they've been 5150'd and then referred to you?
Our office works very closely with mental health, but we only pick up cases after they go through a process of a 5150, a 14-day certification, and then the court process as well.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any further questions? Yes.
You were talking about the necessity for a conservatorship isn't necessarily incompetence.
No.
Right.
Right.
And so you said medically would be a reason, making medical decisions. And what were the other two? I said three. What are the reasons, not aside from incompetence?
I think the three reasons that I was stating was that what a conservatorship does, that it shifts the responsibility,
okay,
the effects of a conservatorship.
Okay.
Those
decision-making...
Right.
Tasks are medical. You gave a couple other examples. One would be medical. They're not incompetent, and they're, because that's separate from dementia powers. Isn't that true? Or is that true?
I think there's two pieces to the information that you're reporting. The effects of a conservatorship have three different effects once a conservatorship is established. It shifts the responsibility from the conservatee to the conservator. It puts limitations on what a conservatee can do that may affect their personal or financial situation. And then it also puts a protection on the conservatee once the conservatorship is established that will protect their personal affairs and their financial affairs. As far as the other piece that you were describing, as far as the medical piece, and the incompetence, what I was explaining was that in our county, we have to petition the court for medical authorities, that in some counties, those authorities are automatically granted upon a petition to the court. In this county, those aren't. So if we want to petition the court for dementia powers, we do so separately, and that would give our office the authority to make medical decisions for our conservatee. The other piece that I wanted to make clear is that some people get the piece confused that when someone is placed on a conservatorship that they're found or declared incompetent, and that is a completely separate issue, separate from a conservatorship. It's not about incompetency. It's about someone being unable to handle their affairs. Incompetency is a completely separate court action.
I see. Okay. And can you give me an example of a personal, somebody not being able to make a personal decision for themselves?
When someone suffers from dementia,
okay,
then they don't have the capacity because of their cognitive deficits to make those personal choices for themselves.
So most of the conservatorships, are they, what's the proportion of dementia?
In our probate cases, we probably have, out of the 28, I would say only 10 of them don't have dementia powers. And also with dementia powers, we have the ability to put them in secured facilities. Most of your skilled nursing facilities are secured. Not necessarily locked, but they're secured. And that's for their own safety. It's people who suffer from Alzheimer's or dementia-related diseases. So we automatically get dementia powers when we get referrals with somebody who has a dementia diagnosis.
Okay.
So a majority of our clients do have.
Two-thirds of those. Okay.
Yeah. But we do get some folks who are elderly that are able to go into residential care. And so we're able to maintain them at that level and not seek dementia powers. They're still able to make their own decisions, and we don't seek those powers until we have to.
Okay. And so what's your caseload? Are you pretty overwhelmed right now, or generally are you overwhelmed, or do you have a manageable caseload for your five people?
We are very busy. It is manageable, but it is a very active, fast-paced office, yes.
And what's the caseload for each person?
We don't have assigned caseloads. We all work on each case together. One of our deputies, who is the social worker full-time, is considered the lead on case management issues. We have a financial person who is responsible for managing the financial pieces of the cases, making sure that the conservatee's bills are paid, that their needs are being met. Oversees the financial investments. We have another deputy who is a specialist in all the governmental benefits and pensions, applies for and maintains all Social Security needs. I oversee all the daily functions of the office. I also do a lot of hands-on with case management stuff. And then we have a part-time investigator who goes out and does all referrals, but all of us are trained and can do each and every one of our jobs. So we all work together as a team.
Okay, thank you.
I appreciate you coming in. I know you're not out looking for more work, I'm sure.
No, we do not solicit for work.
Right. But I'm just curious because I know that as sometimes, whether it's in a neighborhood or something, there's you begin to wonder about what's happening with somebody, and as far as people may know, there's no family.
Correct.
And so is what would be the best scenario for someone if they really are concerned? Are you kind of the last piece where they would call, or do they call and you could check on it, or what would you suggest?
The public guardian's office is the last resort for appointment. So we want to make sure that all other efforts have been attempted. We are also not a first responder. Adult Protective Services is considered a first responder agency. So we always would like to have people call Adult Protective Services so they can go out and do a welfare check, so to speak, and see if there's services that they can implement. Adult Protective Services, of course, won't do any long-term case management, but they can see if an individual would like to have services implemented in the home, kind of do an assessment, that sort of thing. But the individual also has to be willing to accept services that Adult Protective Services is offering. If Adult Protective Services feels that it's a case that's warranted for public guardian action, they will make a referral to us. But also a neighbor or yourself or a friend's family can also make a referral directly to the public guardian's office, and we will go out and do an investigation. So we get those calls as well. If someone calls our office directly, we're not going to say, sorry, you need to call Adult Protective Services. We'll go out and do the investigation and make a stop and see what's going on. So you're welcome.
Yes.
I'd like to add my thanks for you coming in. I'm not clear on what this PE program is. What does PE stand for?
Representative Payee Program. It is acts as a payee.
I misheard you.
That's okay. A payee is designated by the Social Security Administration. And Social Security makes a determination based on the fact that an individual could be eligible for their benefits, either because they suffer from a mental illness or a drug and alcohol disability, but they're not eligible to receive their benefits directly because of a history of not being able to manage their funds appropriately. And that's based on the medical history or in records that they provided the agency directly. So Social Security requires them to have a payee. It could be a private payee. It could be an agency payee. So the Public Guardian's Office has the program that they've set up, and we act as that payee for Social Security. So we receive and disperse those funds accordingly, but we don't provide any case management services. Yeah. 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 And we're able to charge a fee for that. It's $37 a month for people who are just disabled through a mental illness, but if they are receiving funds because of a drug and alcohol, then Social Security allows us to charge $72 per month. And every year that will go up, but the last couple of years that has not increased due to the economy and due to the federal budget. So
on the on that program, are any of these people homeless?
Yes. Not very many, but there are a few.
Yes.
Okay, so I do have a question on that. So those that have drug and alcohol issues are being case managed? Are they being case managed by County Drug and Alcohol? Or who case manages them to deal with their drug and alcohol problem?
Mental health, with services being provided as well through drug and alcohol.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay. So as I mentioned, as a part of my introductory comments, I'll make some general sort of high-level overview comments about behavioral health. I could refer you back to the agency org chart for just a moment. Dr. Anderson and Ms. Neeson are just two of what I believe are an extremely competent group of division managers. I don't know if we have 16 or 17. It depends on whether you count human resources and IT, but Dr. Baylor, Dr. Bornstein, Dr. Anderson, Mike Stevens, who's the Deputy Director for Administration, and Lisa. And then what you see there are the divisions within the Public Health Department and the Behavioral Health Department, and then Mike's administrative unit. So those are the division level, division manager level positions. I think you're probably pretty familiar with the Public Health Department component of the health agency just because of your historic perspective and purview over public health and medical care delivery system issues versus the behavioral health side, where we do have a mental health board and a drug and alcohol advisory board who have existed for a long time to concern themselves with our programs and to, you know, essentially perform that same role that you that the health commission performs on the health side. We do have a couple positions that have been vacant for some time, and I'm not sure whether Marcia and Deanne Purcell are still shown, Gene, on the version. I can't see, but so I don't know if Dr. Bornstein has mentioned Marcia Bollinger's retirement. She's actually still around a little bit, helping us on a temporary basis. But the healthcare services division that Ms. Bollinger was the over which she was the division manager, we have been actively engaged in a recruitment and think we have a person coming on board August 22nd. Okay, so that's good news. A very competent accountant. Deanne Purcell, who's shown under Mike's part of the organization under fiscal and healthcare services, who was providing high-level accounting duties to the healthcare services division for the CMSP program and for the jail medical law enforcement medical care program. Sheriff's office stole her via a promotion a couple months ago, as is often the case as people avail themselves of promotional opportunities in the county, move from one department to another, and we're very close to filling that important position right now as well. Not going to get into a discussion about the minor organizational changes that we are in the middle of discussing with the administrative office, but maybe we can come back to that if you have questions about that. Behavioral health is really four operational programs and then a program quality improvement, PQI is what we call it, but it's a quality assurance. It's an in-house quality assurance program that's listed on the org chart as, yeah, performance and quality improvement, Dr. Gehrman, PhD. The other programs are adult services, youth services, drug and alcohol services, and the Mental Health Services Act, MHSA, programs that we've been growing over the last 5 years since the passage of Prop 63 in 2004. And then you also see medical services listed. It's really not a division of the Behavioral Health Department. That's Dr. Alano, the medical director of the mental health programs under the Behavioral Health Department. She's the medical director is essentially the ranking, the chief psychiatrist, supervising the rest of the staff psychiatrists as well as the contract psychiatrists and those that we procure, the locum tenens contractors that we occasionally have need to employ due to the difficulty that we have to recruit and retain psychiatrists in the county. So the adult and youth services divisions are essentially the core mental health services that the county's been in the business of providing for decades. else. That so first we thought EI. If you had an opportunity. Necessary to re-enter.
week. Seen repeat. Continuous. For itself. Scene. Answer school.
Come back to
disclosure of agreement that was to negotiate.
hospital.
And expand. Question.
your report.
On the bear.
to do so.
Don't. SenCal.
is providing.
Has no
I'll second.
Is
in the hospital.
Any other?
Commissioner. things that are going.
Mm-hmm.